From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and I promise we're not going to squeeze all the fun and silliness out of Monty Python and the Holy Grail by talking about it and analyzing it. Those of us who love the film love it because of its absurdity. But the movie isn't just nonsense words, of course. It's funny because it's making fun of the things that bug us, like superstition and privilege and the pretentious. And even though it's set in the Middle Ages, it turns out the movie tells us a lot about what was going on in the 70s. Seriously, you can find all of that in a ridiculous story of a legendary itinerant king making his way through ancient Britain. It's the 40th anniversary of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we have on the program today an expert, a scholar, to help us talk about it. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I can't actually believe it's been nearly 40 years since a group of friends and I accidentally wandered into the wrong theater and discovered Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which had already started, by the way. We were supposed to be watching a John Wayne movie, but there on the screen in front of us was a scene where King Arthur cuts off the arms and legs of a very stubborn black knight. Now, how could you leave after seeing a scene like that? And of course, we stayed in the theater. In fact, we sat through to the next showing, which you could do in those days. And like a lot of you, we talked about the movie endlessly and memorized whole sequences. Now, I was pretty young at the time, so I didn't get a lot of the cultural references, but you didn't really have to know it to just understand that it was crazy, silly, and something brilliant. And today in the program, we are going to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Helping us is Professor Daryl Larson, a Python scholar, if ever there was one. Daryl Larson is a professor in both the Media Arts Department and the Center for Animation at Brigham Young University, where he teaches film and animation and screenwriting and pop culture studies. He's the author of several books about the Monty Python comedy troupe, including his newest. It's called A Book About the Film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, all the references from African swallows to Zoot. And Professor, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, I copped to my first experience. What was yours? Do you remember seeing Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
I don't honestly remember if I saw it when I was quite young. I remember hearing about it. My first experience with Monty Python was seeing the title of Monty Python's Flying Circus in our local TV guide. And remembering that I wasn't allowed to stay up to watch it.
Right.
And that was on our local public PBS station.
Right.
And I was interested in it, and I knew it had some naughty things in it, and so I was not allowed. And this was in Central California in the 1970s. But as far as Holy Grail goes, it was much later, probably after high school, probably in one of the midnight movie showings that we regularly attended when I was in high school and thereafter. Discovered it, probably sandwiched between a Led Zeppelin film and something more objectionable, where we found ourselves spending an awful lot of time. This was one of the treasures that immediately became the thing we quoted over and over and over again.
So, yeah, that's what I did. We memorized the sequences, which was quite a trick in those days because you couldn't go to YouTube and find the scene. I mean, you had to go and see it again.
You had to pay that $2 and get back into the theater.
Right, the $2, exactly. So let's talk about at what point you decided you wanted to kind of – we should explain what the book is, which is really – how do you describe it? Because in some ways this is how you put it in the introduction to the book. You say it's a study of the worlds that could produce such a film. Does that get to it?
It does. First off, it's a book that I wasn't going to do. I'd done a Flying Circus book, which was, again, about the world as seen through the eyes of Flying Circus. And I figured this book had been done – I mean this movie had been done and done and done by other books and articles and websites and that sort of thing. Ad infinitum, I'd imagine. Then I found out at some point that my publisher was actually interested in this kind of book, and I guess it's no surprise by this point. But it, So I entered into it with some trepidation. Once I got into it, though, I realized that this was not unlike, and this might sound sacrilegious, not unlike reading some of the texts I was doing as I was working on my doctorate, the Shakespeare texts and the Spencer texts and Ben Jonson and others. Yes, those are the names. And realizing that even after only a few years, the references and the things that are being mentioned and alluded to in Monty Python's work, and then specifically in Monty Python, the Holy Grail, were disappearing rather quickly, being obscured by, you know, new traditions, new words, new lexicon. And so it was easy for me to justify taking the book, taking the film and looking at it as that kind of text that needed to be looked at very carefully for it to reveal itself. So it became a prism, I think I say in the introduction, through which I looked at the medieval time that it's allegedly set, the Arthurian time, which is, of course, a little more mythological.
Yeah.
But then what ends up being most interesting to me was the fact that it seemed to be very much set in 1973-74 Great Britain.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to actually break that down because I think that's really interesting. There's one thing you mentioned that's going on in Britain at the time, in the early 70s. There's this British historian, John Morris, who publishes what I gather was kind of this is like the definitive book about the Arthurian legend.
It is. The Age of Arthur. It's an impressive, thick tome that the Pythons probably would have had a lot of fun making fun of.
Right.
It actually is a very interesting read and for the most part, a fairly accurate read. But what it ends up doing is in 1973, it ends up drawing an awful lot of conclusions about Arthur as an historical figure that just couldn't be supported.
Morris thinks he existed.
That's right, absolutely. And then found ways to insert him into multiple areas of British history in ways that in 1973, during the difficult times of the early 70s in Britain, probably answered a lot of questions, helped the British reader feel a lot better about themselves, said, here's our hero again. We're recovering him. We're bringing him back to the fore. It's a very popular book, well-read, but almost immediately jumped on by other scholars who said,
nonsense.
You've done your homework, but
The
conclusions you drew here, here, and here, specifically where Arthur becomes a historical figure without question, those are the things that got shot down very, very quickly. And so only 4 years later, when another
This is David Dumville.
Dumville, yes, another eminent professor from the period, writes his fairly short but somewhat scathing article, not nasty, but to the point, saying we just have no evidence to say Arthur existed historically. Let's stop talking about Arthur as a historical figure. Between those two dates, 73 and 77, that's when this film appeared.
Yeah. And you know what I love about – there's something that seems kind of symbolic about all of that because on one hand you have John Morris who says, hey, he was a figure and he starts to boost and inflate the British psyche again. And then you have – this is so British, it seems to me. You have Dumville who completely deflates the whole idea. It's like it seemed like the people of Great Britain, they needed that boost and Dumville and I would have to say the Pythons weren't really having it. Like, this is not reality.
The Pythons were the right age to not have any of it.
Yeah.
They were all post-undergrads, of course, and had found their way into bits of academia. But by this time, we're all working for the BBC. But it's a period where there are multiple issues going on in relation to Arthurian studies. There are authors who are finding – I think I list in the book three separate significant authors from the late 60s and early – authors from the late 60s and early 70s who are writing about the historical author based on primarily archaeological evidence that they are – they're looking for Camelot is what they're looking for.
Right.
And by the way, the newspapers think this is interesting and so the newspapers send people out to these digs, which are usually very dull and take forever. Well, the newspapers want stories. And so it doesn't take very long in the late 1960s for these generally careful historians and archaeologists to sort of bend a little bit to perhaps the pressure of the media and the fact that the dig was being paid for by some corporate interests. And then the newspapers started to talk about, yes, we may have found Camelot here in Sudbury, or we may have found Camelot out here in Glastonbury, that sort of thing. And it made good copy, and it was good reading for 4 or 5 years prior even to the publication of Morris's book in 1973. So the pythons had all this, of course, in the newspapers, which is where they got an awful lot of their material. They had a lot of this at their fingertips, Palin and Jones specifically, as they sat down to figure out what they wanted to do for a feature film. So it's actually kind of no surprise that even though during the entire run of Flying Circus, Arthur is not mentioned, he's not significant, the Arthurian tale, which is perhaps an interesting, conspicuous absence, he becomes front and center of this first original feature film they decide to create. And yet it is all about deflating an idea of what a larger-than-life, very English Arthur practically or positively could have been.
The film is so brilliant, I thought anyway, in what they do with Camelot, which is raise it as an idea and as a place, and then pretty quickly it's a silly place.
A single song gets rid of Camelot, which is fine. It's an awful lot of fun. And I think in the script itself, the cue for that says a sort of "If You Can See Me Now" kind of song they break into, which was an original song that they created for the film. Idle, of course, doing most of the songwriting
duties. Yeah, Eric Idle, amazing.
Terrific, yeah, musician. But it doesn't take very long for that ideal to be declared silly, and the quest, pausing for a moment, moves off in a different direction. And it's at that moment that God appears and the real quest begins.
What I love too is just how many decisions were made in that film based on the fact that they didn't have the money for horses, for example. This is the coconut thing I actually want to come back to. But also, they probably didn't have the budget to create much of a Camelot. So you just dispense with it with a cheap musical number.
And that is part of the, if you want trivia or background stuff that's in the book, talking about how, you know, the very small budget. Once they got to the site, they had envisioned shooting in multiple castles, which they'd had permission to shoot in. But it didn't take very long for the Scottish authorities to realize that they didn't want these funsters messing around in their castles and perhaps casting some sort of aspersion on cult Scottish history,
right.
Which the pythons later would find very funny, that all the scene of murder and mayhem in these castles over the years was much more preferred to just some silliness and dancing. So they ended up having to use primarily just one major castle. That's Doon Castle, mm-hmm. which is now a very popular tourist destination.
I bet.
Where the gift shop, yes, sells coconuts. And there's all sorts of home videos of people walking around the castle, clip-clopping. And then they got some pickup shots. Julian Doyle, their man everything on the shoot, got pickup shots of other castles in Wales and that sort of thing to help fill out the rest of the film. But almost everything you see when they're inside a castle is there in that one castle, which is sort of the magic of film to begin with, right? Turn a camera one way.
But so much just plays out in the countryside.
Absolutely. But it's an unadorned countryside.
Right.
And I think one of the things I point out in the book, which was I didn't think about when I was first watching the film, is that even though it's a medieval film set in medieval England in supposedly the 10th century, there's no indication that the 10th century structures or peoples or organization or hierarchy or anything actually exists. All of it would have been too expensive. They shot on no Roman or Norman or Saxon. They shot on none of those ruins. They couldn't afford to be on the roads. They were too protected. They couldn't be. They were in no furrowed fields, anything. They were just out in the country.
Yeah.
That's what they could afford. So I think what I point out is part of the film's charm is that they had to do without. And so everything had to be as creative as possible with as little stuff as possible and certainly with no money. And it ends up being a much better film.
No, I think so too. And I guess there's that thread, which we'll come back to too, going throughout the film where Arthur is being investigated by modern British law enforcement. There's
yes.
a murder early on.
Yes.
And then arrested, obviously. And really, what I think is so interesting about that thread is that it seems like it's just a bit of silliness on one hand. But on the other hand, and you write about this in the book, this is also a really perfect way of explaining how the modern world intrudes on the story. And that's kind of a theme.
That's right. The modern world refuses to allow this kind of story to happen anymore. And part of the reason I think I really wanted to do the book was to actually situate the film in the canon of film from the period. Generally, it's plucked out of the rest of filmdom because it's silly and funny and just an enjoyable farce from a particular period, from these lads in Great Britain.
Yeah.
What I tried to show is that it actually adheres to an awful lot of the new wave characteristics of films, very serious films from this period. And then if you're comparing it to other films, it's as much about – it's as much like Ingmar Bergman's much-respected Seventh Seal.
Totally.
Or Roman Polanski's equally respected version of Macbeth from 1971.
Kurosawa's version of that same film.
Absolutely. Throne of Blood.
Throne of Blood. Uh-huh. Well, there's that moment at the beginning, and I was just reading this before I came in here. Everyone remembers the moment where Arthur and Patsy – confront the two sentries at the castle, and then the coconut thing, which is so great. But there's all this smoke, and it's dark, and but you say that's a reference to a Kurosawa film.
Absolutely, absolutely. Partially, they're shooting in April and May in Scotland. You're going to get
crummy weather,
some darkness.
Yeah,
it's going to be wet, and it was, and they were miserable and complained about it over and over again. But it really makes the film look good. But the beginnings of those films, especially the beginning of Throne of Blood, is as atmospheric
with the
fog and the sound of the volcanic gravel under the feet of the horses and that sort of thing. It's a remarkable beginning as they're lost there, as they're trying to find the castle. This kind of setting is the way they set up this film. And so that the film can start with, you know, an image of a dead person up on a Catherine wheel and a knight and the sound of horses approaching.
Yeah.
And you realize, okay, this is going to be serious. This is something we've seen already. We're ready for this. But of course, if you know the pythons, which the folks going to the movie probably were waiting for, they're waiting for that other shoe to drop. It's when they crest the hill and you realize, okay, there's no horses.
Yeah.
What's that second guy doing? He's hitting something together. And it's a deflation right off the bat.
Absolutely.
And you say, all right, here's where we are. This is where we're going to be for the rest of the film.
It's interesting. You ask this question in the book. Is this an art film?
I do.
What do you think?
It is an art film because it flies in the face of what we would call traditional film, which is sort of the description, the thumbnail description of what an art film has classically been. So whether it's the narrative structure, whether it's the kind of characters we're looking at, whether it's when or where the film is set, that sort of thing. There's all sorts of ways to describe an art film. This one does poke fun at and try to puncture the serious films that it's looking at, the films that are, the French New Wave films, for example, of Truffaut and Godard and others, there are bits and pieces of these. So, yeah, this is certainly fits into that art film world. But at the same time, it is making fun of those art films. It sort of is able to have its cake and eat it, too.
I want to play a scene. This is do we have the coconut scene? Oh, good. We do. Okay. Well, let's play some of that. Will you set this up for what, like it, just, it? Does it just come out of nowhere? The coconuts. I mean, you say that's kind of a reference to the Goon Show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, certainly. It's the coconuts wouldn't have been a surprise to older members of the audience watching this, because older members of the audience would have remembered the radio shows they grew up listening to, and they understood that on those radio shows they did not bring horses into the studio to pretend to have horses running around. They would actually clip-clop with coconut shells, and those actually sounded remarkably good in a sort of Foley environment of a radio show. The Goons had employed this. The Goons were a 1951 to 1960 BBC radio show that the Pythons all grew up listening to, fairly worshiping and making sure they were there Sunday night to listen to it, which Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan and Harry Secombe. Marvelous show. A lot of it's still in existence. Incredibly worth listening to. But they over and over again on that show drew attention to the fact that the stuff they were doing was fake. And that if you heard a sound effect, that was actually a sound effect. That was not three doors opening. It was one door open three times. That sort of thing. The Pythons very naturally, I think, probably without even thinking about it, just brought it right into their
world. Well, they're breaking down the fourth wall. Yeah. And especially in the movie. And this is the sequence we'll actually hear, because the sentry – He brings up this uncomfortable fact that you're not on a horse, you are clopping together coconuts. Here's the scene.
We have ridden since the snows of winter covered this land, through the kingdom of Mercia, through...
Where'd you get the coconuts?
We found them.
Found them? In Mercia, the coconut's tropical.
What do you mean?
Well, this is a temperate zone.
The swallow may fly south with the sun, or the house martin or the plover may seek warmer climes in winter, yet these are not strangers to our land.
Are you suggesting coconuts migrate?
Not at all. They could be carried.
What? A swallow carrying a coconut?
It could grip it by the husk.
It's not a question of where he grips it. It's a simple question of weight ratios. A 5-ounce bird could not carry a 1-pound coconut.
Well, it doesn't matter. Will you go and tell your master?
And it goes on and on.
It's marvelous. There's entire websites dedicated now to the airspeed velocity of unladen swallows. They're all over
and
the place.
How many people have actually weighed?
I'm sure they've tried.
Swallows.
So I don't spend a lot of time on those things because you could find them elsewhere.
Yeah, you
but
can.
It makes for a remarkable scene. That scene is also fascinating because that's one of the few moments where an actual historical thing is mentioned.
Mercia
is mentioned. Yeah. And it's actually an odd moment where everything could go off the rails, I suppose, historically, because here the pythons have put together a mythological figure, Arthur, with a historical mention, Mercia. Of course, Mercia had disappeared essentially a few generations before this film is allegedly set.
Yeah.
But I guess it shows that they're not afraid of the historical trying to upend their ahistorical world. Like Shakespeare and Falstaff.
It's a melange.
Absolutely.
And it seems like, too, and this is one of the things you point out in the book as well, is because you say that, yes, it was sort of the Middle Ages. It was supposed to be the Middle Ages, but it wasn't really the Middle Ages. I mean, there are knights and castles and peasants and plagues. And you ask in the book, but what's missing? Turns out most of the Middle Ages. What do you mean?
There's a little laundry list I go through there.
Yeah.
And it's based on my own researches. I've read book after book of the period from the scholars of the period. And these are the scholars that the pythons would have been forced to read as they were going through their studies at Cambridge and Oxford. But it's true. You know, the windmills that would have been everywhere, the highways that would have been everywhere, the large cities, which would have been fairly easy to find, even the smaller cities, which would have been even easier to find.
And bustling with people.
Absolutely. Lots of people. This was a crowded country, as a matter of fact. And it took, unfortunately, a series of plagues to thin that out eventually. But again, that comes down to what the pythons couldn't afford. They couldn't.
Right.
The extras were family members. The extras were University of Stirling students who wanted to come down for a couple of days for £2 plus lunch and have memories they'd never forget.
No kidding. And get super muddy.
Absolutely. And run down a hill over and over again.
Right.
And I got some letters from them, and they still fondly think back to those days. They had an awful lot of fun.
Let me play another scene. I'm going to try to play as many as possible because they're just so terrific.
Please.
So early on in the film, of course, Arthur is on his pursuit. He has his trusty Patsy with him, and they encounter a person he thinks is a woman at first. It's Dennis the peasant, and it's not his wife, I guess. It's his mother, right?
It is his mother.
Him. Yeah, yeah. And what follows is sort of this brilliant kind of explication about governments and this dispute about the rights of king and how it should be. What do we know about this scene, how it plays out happens in the film?
It is a mixture of all the writers in the group. The political, in-your-face political stuff is from Palin and Jones, who are a writing team.
Michael Palin and Terry Jones.
And Terry Jones. And the mythological stuff, the Arthur talking about the sword and the lady from the lake and that sort of thing, that is classic John Cleese and Graham Chapman. And then you put those together, and what you have is just this obstreperous or angry or in-your-face peasant who doesn't fit in 932 AD or the 13th century or whatever. He fits now in 1973 at the front of a picket queue at a coal mine, yelling for the cameras, and this is where that's borrowed from.
Wow, and it really, you get a sense that the people who are disputing this idea of, you know, of the royals, that's in here too.
Absolutely. Is this an attack on the sitting monarchy? It probably was, or at least it's a comment on the sitting monarchy. There were a number of years that the British royal family struggled with their reputation, and it was, especially in this time of how much it costs to run the royal households and the castles.
It's always a question there, too, isn't it?
Very expensive. Yeah. Right now, I think we're in a pretty good spot. There was some rough patches that they went through. But certainly, the Pythons are asking questions about what gives you the right to rule me?
In the case of purely internal affairs...
Be quiet!
But by a two-thirds majority, in the case of more...
Be quiet! I order you to be quiet!
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
Be quiet!
But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
I mean, if I went round saying I was an emperor just because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they'd put me away.
And then he gets to that part where, as you said, is probably it's that image of somebody in front of a camera. I'm being repressed.
That's
I'm
right.
being attacked.
That's right. Record this. This is important.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, this
and that's so funny about it, too, because I actually never noticed this until I was watching it again recently. There are so many references from characters into the camera, which is such a conceit today. You see a lot, you know, in the sort of The Office era when people are referencing this camera. That, it must have been remarkable for its time.
That is one of the reasons it could be called an art film.
Yeah.
It fits in there. Buñuel's making films during this period, Luis Buñuel. The Milky Way, for example, comes to mind from 1969, where characters do turn and address the camera. Jean-Luc Godard also has his characters, garbage men, telling us the evils of capitalist society as they stand on a garbage tip right into the camera. So yet there's this idea of reaching out and implicating the viewer. So we've broached that. We won't see that in Hollywood film. That's way too scary and way too personal, and we don't want to forget the illusion. But, of course, the Pythons and the New Wave are all about breaking down those illusions.
Darrell Larson is with us, professor of media arts at Brigham Young University. He has a lot of roles there. I mentioned them before. His new book is called A Book About the Film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, all the references from African swallows to Zoot. And we need to take a break. We're far past a break, but we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and today in the program we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Monty Python and the Holy Grail with Darrell Larson. He has a book about the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It's called All the References from African Swallows to Zoot. Well, Zoot comes up. You know, I hadn't realized, I mean, there's this funny French sentry.
Yeah.
And in fact, we have this scene. In fact, let's play it. Well, do you want to set this up for us? This idea of the French taunting the British is kind of a thing.
It is kind of a thing, and it has at least two bases here. We have one, of course, the idea that after the Norman invasion, guess what? There's an awful lot of French that call England home and will for the next several hundred years, and a good portion of England is controlled by the French, the entire area. So that's the one thing. So it shouldn't have been really a surprise to encounter them. Though if this is 932, that would be a surprise. But
yeah.
After 1066, no. But also in mid-1960s, England had started its full court press attempt to get into the common market. And they thought it would be in their best interest to be able to deal on the same level with agricultural things and selling and buying with the rest of the EEC. And the French president at the time, de Gaulle, was absolutely saying no. And he said no multiple times to them, and it wouldn't happen until 1973. So there's years of the French essentially standing at the gates of their own fortress, of Fortress Europe,
right,
and saying, you're not invited. Why? Because you're you. And number two, because you like the Americans. So stay away.
Well, in this scene, Arthur and his knights approach a French castle and demand to see the Grail.
If you will not show us the Grail, we shall take your castle by force.
You don't frighten us, English pig dogs. Go and boil your bottom, sons of a silly person. I'll blow my nose at you, so-called Arthur King. You and all your silly English kniggets.
What a strange person.
And then there's a line that everyone remembers. I fart in your general direction.
General direction.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that the censor asked be removed if they wanted to get the best rating, but they fought for it and got to keep it.
They fought for a lot of things. You mentioned there was as a curse, Jesus Christ is there. That's in the rabbit scene, I remember. There's references to oral sex. There's curse words, obviously. The F-bomb appears in the film. Did they fight for all of that?
They fought for them, but they didn't put up much of a fight, especially for the F-bomb. That one, actually, if you watched closely, there's a scene where you can see that they've looped in a different word for someone saying the F-bomb.
Right.
And what they wanted, of course, was the mildest rating so that they get the broadest possible audience.
Yeah.
I think they already knew that it was a bit of a challenge to sell this film because audiences weren't quite going to know what to they're getting. So they picked their battles and ended up keeping some of the what we might call friendlier, I suppose, curse words and those sorts of things and epithets.
Yeah. The friendlier.
Which are the – yeah, and the ones that get said and repeated over and over again.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So what was the reaction when it comes out? I mean, it seems like there was a slow burn.
Yeah.
Once it got to America, it seemed like it just went crazy.
That's the key. It was very much a slow burn, and maybe even to this day in Great Britain. It opened up fairly mildly. It had showed first in Los Angeles at the Filmex, where they screened films they were trying to sell. And it had done very, very well there. And audiences had responded really, really well. And so they are excited, brought it back to England to show it in April 1975. And the response was, oh, that's funny. That's interesting. You read the reviews of the film at that time based on its April 1975 release. And they're saying, well, it's funny. There's sequences. If you liked Flying Circus, you'll probably like this. But were they praising it to the heavens and saying this is the next greatest thing? No. It took years, and it really took college campuses in this country showing the film and the other Python works over and over again, oftentimes interesting, as I found out, for fundraising to get people really interested.
In the book, you call it a transmissible cultural artifact, especially in the United States.
Absolutely.
Which is meaning what? Just what we were talking about. I stumble into a theater, find it. Can't stop talking about it.
It appeals to you on some level. You then probably wouldn't have appealed to your parents at that level. Really, really important.
Very.
And then it becomes yours because
it was
memorize
our secret,
it
our
and you
cult.
Bring it into you bring it into yourself, and so it is yours. And then yes, you transmit it to others as you repeat it ad nauseum, perhaps. So absolutely, and that really only happens in this country as opposed to Great Britain. It's respected in Great Britain, but it becomes a huge hit here.
A real classic. We need to talk about the animation, which it's hard to pull an audio clip.
For some reason.
For the animation. But there is a moment we were thinking about, actually, where God appears as a piece of animation, brilliantly done, of course, to give Arthur and his knights their mission for the Holy Grail. Let's play this sequence, and then we can talk about the animation.
Arthur, King of the Britons, your knights of the Round Table shall have a task to make them an example in these dark times.
Good idea, O Lord.
Of course it's a good idea. Behold, Arthur, this is the Holy Grail. Look well, Arthur, for it is your sacred task to seek this grail. That is your purpose, Arthur. The quest for the Holy Grail.
Good idea, oh Lord. So great.
Great idea. That is a terrific transition, too. That's the moment that the rest of the film starts. Before that, it's just Arthur gathering knights to Camelot, the very traditional sort of approach.
And there are a couple of things going on I want you to talk about here, because you've got live action sequence responding to animation. Not entirely novel, but this was an important part of the animation sequences.
Certainly.
In the circus as well as in this particular film.
The Pythons had prepped audiences for this throughout Flying Circus because they were, you know, audiences were used to characters being live characters being put into animated backgrounds, animated figures being put onto live backgrounds, that sort of thing. There was interaction already. And of course, we'd seen it in several Hollywood films, so it wasn't totally new. The special effects, of course, about as low-tech as you can imagine, shooting the treetops and then inserting God in later. They used the image of the eminent cricketer, W.G. Grace.
Now, this is all Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, this is – well, the Gilliam brings together all these images.
Yeah.
My guess is there was some talking about some of these, but yes, Gilliam generally worked on his own. And on this film, since he was co-director, he was working more closely with the other co-director, Terry Jones, making decisions for these things. So there may have been some discussion about that. But they'd already used that image of Grace, W.G. Grace, in this film, in the series. So this was an easy borrow to bring it right into this film. English audiences would have recognized that character right off the bat. Western audiences, I mean, American audiences probably did not recognize that character. So it's a remarkable moment where a sort of angry, shirty god, as you might say, a little less angry than the original script was, because in the original script, God is kind of mean and plays tricks on them and sort of willy-nilly kills people and hurts the knights. And so they pulled back on that and they'd go full force in the Life of Brian eventually.
But, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. It seems like that's where they really go force on. And that should be your next book, by the way.
That's what I
heard. Are you thinking about
it? That's what I've
heard. Is that a tougher one to do on the BYU campus?
No. It's,
really?
Will it be sold in the bookstore? I'm not entirely sure. But could I do it? Yes, I could do it. And I've been asked to do it by the publisher. I'm just not certain I'm going to do it. We'll
see.
You're
up for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Stuff has been written about it. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't decided yet. Thank you.
I want to say something too about, just because this was, I think, one of my favorite things as a kid, and you almost don't notice it when it happens, but it's the opening sequence, the titles at the beginning. Talk a little bit about that. Well, no, let's say this first. So first, when you go in to watch this movie, it seems like there's this 1950s film about a dentist.
Yes.
And then it just stops, and then something else completely kicks in, and you get into these credits. Talk a little bit about that, because they're so funny. This is when there's this sort of faux Swedish subtitles going on, and the references to the moose, and then the moose transitions into the llama, and it's so funny.
That's all budget. That is budget and Michael Palin. Because the film was essentially finished. They wanted a credit sequence that was going to be impressive. They had no money left to do a credit sequence that was impressive. They wanted it mostly animated by Gilliam. So they wanted a very nice, long, beautiful credit sequence. And so Palin started writing out ideas based on the films that they had watched coming from Sweden and realizing they'd been reading subtitles forever. And again, this is one of those direct references to The Seventh Seal, where if you're going to make fun of a serious film, boy, go ahead and pull out all the stops and make fun. The seriousness can go on the screen, but underneath we're going to be commenting about molars and about erotic dentists and the way things are in Norway. It's a remarkable scene. Most of it was done after the film was complete, after it had been screened at least once. Audiences hadn't seen it. The Pythons themselves hadn't seen it. In fact, Cleese mentions that he never saw it until a much later screening, and he thought it was absolutely hilarious. But it was brand new to him. As well.
Oh, so funny. So and there's this sequence here that I want to read this sequence, which is probably a sequence you see in every credit sequence of every movie. The characters and incidents portrayed and the names used are fictitious, and any similarity to the names, characters, or history of the person is entirely accidental and unintentional.
Uh-huh.
And then it says, signed
Richard M. Nixon. Richard M. Nixon. If you read Michael Palin's diaries, he comments on Nixon and the White House of that period often.
Yeah.
And he has a great, great dislike for what's going on.
This is 1975.
And going back to even 68, you know, if, during the election, 72 during the re-election, it's Nixon is the bad guy throughout, just because he's sort of the opposite of what many of the Pythons see themselves as being. So that's no surprise that he shows up there. He shows up throughout Flying Circus, Nixon does, and he's always the butt of some joke. So it's not just Nixon. There's other names in that, and those credits are also actually of real people, of course. So that's part of the joke.
Darrell Larson is with us, professor of media arts at Brigham Young University. His new book, it's a thickie. How many pages is that sucker?
632.
It's great. It's called A Book About the Film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. All the references from African Swallows to Zoot. I need to take another quick break, though. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, celebrating 40th anniversary of The Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, with Darrell Larson, a professor of media arts at Brigham Young University, has a great book breaking really every moment down in the film. It's called A Book About the Film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, all the references from African Swallows to Zoot. One of my favorite parts of the book is because it had always been so baffling, and I always just sort of assumed it was just a bit of nonsense, and maybe in many ways it sort of is. But the knights who say nay. Should we talk about it first, or should we play it?
Go ahead and play it.
Yeah, let's play a sequence.
Let's hear it.
If you know the film, you know the knights who say nay.
Who are you?
We are the knights who say nay.
No, not the knights who say nay.
The same.
Poor thee.
We are the keepers of the sacred words. Nay, peng, and nay-wum.
Those who hear them seldom live to tell the tale.
The knights who say nay demand a sacrifice.
Knights of nay, we are but simple travelers who seek the enchanter who lives beyond these woods.
Nay. We shall say nay again to you if you do not appease us.
Well, what is it you want?
We want a shrubbery.
A what?
Nay.
Please, no.
Where did that come from?
That is actually, it's again, got a couple of sources. Throughout the Arthurian sources they found in Le Morte d'Arthur, Malory's work, Thomas Malory.
Thomas Malory. Yeah, that was their Arthur.
That was their Arthur, right? Yeah. The majestic, battle-ready Arthur. Throughout those, there are these kinds of encounters with mystical, supernatural knights and witch types and sorcerers and that sort of thing. And there's always something. It's usually a little more noble than either a shrubbery as an offering or a word like knee that's going to paralyze you. But these encounters at bridges, at fords, at castles, at crossroads, they happen throughout those sources. So it's really no surprise to find this and something like the Black Knight in this sort of world. They're making fun of those original sources.
And making it just silly.
It is silly. And the words themselves are certainly borrows from the Goon Show. Yeah. Spike Milligan's world is – he creates these words. Knee is technically not one of the words. I can say that having listened to every episode. But there are dozens of words like that that are also imbued with significance and even power in the Goon Show world. And that's what we have here. We have this word, this nonsense word that can actually stop the quest in its tracks until you do something silly like deliver a shrubbery.
What do we know what shrubbery is?
Do we know what it is?
Well, there's a question that's come about whether or not shrubbery – I've heard it's British slang for a prostitute. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, that's probably fairly accurate, but would the Pythons been thinking of that at this point? Probably not. What they're looking for is something as silly as – what a DIYer, a do-it-yourselfer, would go down to the local Home Depot or whatever that was called in the UK and buy on a Saturday afternoon and bring home.
Yeah, exactly. That's so much better. There is one of the scenes we don't have, but I do want to talk about because it seems like the idea of the plague and people just dropping dead, the bring out your dead scene is such a great scene as well. And one thing you write about, I really liked this, that the imagery probably came from a Hieronymus Bosch painting.
Bosch painting, yeah. Sure. A lot of their work is influenced by other things artistic. You know, these are well-read. You know, if it was Shakespeare's time, we'd call them university wits. That's what they were. They had the education. They had the museum time. In fact, go to the National Gallery today. You can still see little versions of the pythons in their blazers and uniforms wandering through those museums. And you can imagine, okay, that's what it was in 1940, 50, 60. Seeing these things, great works of art, and eventually, maybe even accidentally, they find their way into their work. The plague section is also one of those sections that is historical. So they have all sorts of things that the audience would already bring with them and understand or think they understand about the plague. And so a pile of dead bodies, people running in the mud, dead people as far as you can see, dogs, etc. And then, of course, a person running the cart who is actually more of a functionary who wants to make sure the rules are...
It's against the regulations.
Yeah, this is a guild, after all.
Right.
Let's make sure we do it right. Which, as I write about, that's actually pretty standard. There were guilds for virtually everything. Yeah. And you didn't do cartage. You didn't do haulage unless you were a member of some certain guild and there was something that you charged and et cetera, et cetera. There were rules.
Let me play a scene from the film, which I think needs really no introduction, and we can talk about it.
What? There he is.
Where?
There.
What, behind the rabbit?
It is the rabbit.
You silly sod.
What?
He goes all worked up.
Well, that's no ordinary rabbit. Oh. That's the most foul, cruel and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on.
You tit. I saw my arm and I was so scared.
Look, that rabbit's got a vicious streak a mile wide. It's a killer.
Get stuck.
He'll do you a treat, mate.
Oh, yeah? Manky Scots git.
I'm warning you.
What's he do? Nibble your bum?
He's got huge, sharp... he can leap about... Look at the bones!
Go on, boys. Chop his head off.
Right, silly little bleeder. One rabbit, two coming right up.
And of course we know what happens. Where did that come from? A flesh-eating rabbit. A killer rabbit.
A killer rodent. That actually, we see that in other works. In fact, there are significant images from medieval texts, illuminated manuscripts, that show seemingly harmless animals attacking larger animals and especially humans. There's a number of them that show hares or rabbits hunting humans. So it's a sort of we're turning the tables, nature, man versus nature, nature's going to win. So we see those all over the place. The pythons have used it. They used it throughout Flying Circus. If you remember the 20th century, the MGM logo comes up at one point, and instead of a roaring lion, it's a squeaking vole, sort of a hamsterish thing or field. Yeah. The diminishment we see throughout their work. They do escalation sketches where things get bigger and bigger, but they also do sort of mock epics where something that seems enormous very, very quickly drops off the table and it becomes nothing more than a tiny, harmless rabbit, which, of course, we climb back up the hill to the rabbit taking someone's head off. That's the world they try and populate there.
Yeah. The Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch, what's that about?
Well, the church shows up, right?
Right.
I'm writing it in this section. It's interesting to me that, you know, throughout, first it's Arthur trying to rely on himself, his sword, his men. At this point, we have the church in the form of Brother Maynard and others. Brother Maynard, and I believe in the script, it's called his roommate, who are with them. And they decide to use the Holy Hand Grenade because they don't have arrows, which was... a bow and arrow, which is quite unusual for this period. But anyway.
That piece of writing is so great, where they talk about the reading of using the hand grenade.
And they do is essentially rewrite portions of existing scripture, which, as I mentioned in the book, read just as in just as convoluted kind of a way as we're, for example, describing the Ark of the Covenant and how it needs to be created and carried and not touch, that sort of thing. Very, very Old Testament, very, very quotidian. To make sure it's done quite right, because yes, there is a God somewhere off screen who will be angry if it's not done
that
properly.
That same conceit appears in Life of Brian, too.
Yes.
Don't you think?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And they actually talk about it in Life of Brian, the idea of followers and how challenging followers can be. And one follower says he knows a savior because he's followed enough of them.
Right. Absolutely. Well, let's talk about the end. What do you make of the end? Because in some ways, like I think I've actually heard people who are not crazy about the end because it seems like you were headed somewhere and then all of a sudden it was just an easy way to get out of it because they ran out of money or something.
Which is actually not the case because guess what? They shot the ending at the very beginning of the film. It had little to do with the money. I think it had everything to do with
them. And we should explain what happens. The cops show up. And
the
just
policemen who've been chasing them up and eventually arrest them and put the hands over the camera and they put the hand over the projector, which is even more interesting if you think about it, so that the film stops. But as I mentioned in the book, is there any other way they could have ended? They could not have ended this with Arthur getting the Grail. They couldn't have ended it with him being celebrated. It can't be heroic. This is not the world they're in. They're saying this is the world where these kinds of dreams are cut short. They can't exist. And so it has to end this way.
Let me ask you finally. So it's become a cult classic for so many of us. But your students that you encounter, do they know it? Are you trying to sort of, you know, say, see this thing? It was in 1975, but you're going to love it. And does it still work for kids of this age?
It actually still does work. I have kids down to 12 in my own house for whom it works very, very well. If they know Monty Python, that's what they know. They know Holy Grail. They don't know Life of Brian. They certainly don't know Flying Circus. And so that's the thing they know, or at least they think they know, or they've been quoting and didn't know they were quoting it for many, many years. So it continues to pay off, which I think is why this book came to be in the first place, that the film itself continues to be popular and of interest many, many years later.
Darrell Larson, professor at BYU and the Media Arts Department and the Center for Animation, his new book, a book about the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, all the references from African Swallows to Zoot. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.